This is The Long Cut, an hour of radio about Uncle Tupelo. They recorded four albums and toured a lot from 1989 to 1993. We'll hear from the three guys in the band. Jeff Tweedy.
I don't know what the band's about. I mean, obviously the world has defined it a little bit. The people that became interested in what we were doing, and especially after the fact.
Mike Hydorn.
It just seemed natural for us to play these songs. We had a great appreciation for a Johnny Cash song, as we would for a Screaming Black Flag song, too.
And Jay Farrar.
You know, folk and country were the types of music that our parents listened to and played. You know, it wasn't something that we had an extreme aversion to, but it was something that, you know, that wasn't the primary thing we wanted to do. We wanted to turn up our amps and play loud music.
We'll meet someone from Uncle Tupelo's Illinois hometown.
My name is Debbie Miller, and I'm the president with the Greater Belleville Chamber of Commerce.
And we have a music critic for those who think they have to have one in a radio show about a band. This is Anthony DeCurtis.
Yeah, Uncle Tupelo is a kind of signifier for a concern for authenticity, for a kind of a desire to make music that's not determined by the mainstream. You know, they have all of that kind of symbolic resonance for, you know, new listeners, and they're endlessly going to be rediscovered.
Yeah, that seems right. That's our cast. Oh, and I'm Lauren Fry. So we'll play a fair bit of music. Tweedy, Hydorn, and Farrar will talk about how they got going, kept it going, and a little about why it stopped when it did. DeCurtis, the music critic, has some things to say about all of that. But as it was better said by someone else, we'll get going at the beginning, and that's Belleville, Illinois. Belleville, Illinois. It's a few miles southeast of East St. Louis. It's all low hills and farm country that's doing a slow roll right into the Mississippi. Belleville's like a lot of the old towns in the Big River Valley. Its fortunes have gone up and down like the commerce that floats by. In the 70s and 80s, when Tweedy, Hydorn, and Farrar were growing up, it was a downtime for Belleville.
Belleville, boy, it's really hard because growing up, you don't really know anything else. You don't know anywhere else. Definitely the kids I grew up with, everybody had some sense, innate sense, that it wasn't all it could be. But it seemed like a very long street and a brewery and a very old downtown that didn't look like it had changed in, you know, 80 years or something like that. So I don't know, it felt really isolated.
It's probably more of a bedroom community than anything else. I mean, it was its own sort of separate entity, I'm sure, at one time. But I think at the time, the town was a population of about 40,000. And, you know, there had to be hundreds of bars. So, yeah, there are a lot of bars in the town. I mean, it's German heritage there. It's pretty much the same situation in St. Louis, where there were a lot of breweries there too. You know, St. Louis is about 30 minutes away.
It's basically a 40,000 populated suburb of St. Louis town in southern Illinois. Has a bunch of railroad tracks going through it, I think more so than most cities. And there's a lot of bars, like every block or so down the world's longest main street. Apparently, it was in the World Guinness Book of Records once upon a time for having the longest main street. And there's a lot of bars on that main street, but there was a big brewery in town. Stag beer was brewed there, so it had some industrial stuff going on, but it was basically your typical small, big city. 40,000, great place to raise kids for our generation. And it's cheap bread prices, milk's cheap, rent's cheap, I like it, I still live there.
Obviously, Belleville means a lot of different things to everyone. Let's check in with Anthony DeCurtis and get his take on the town.
If you think about REM and the B-52s in Athens, Georgia, if you think about Bruce Springsteen in Asbury Park, if you think about Lou Reed in New York, you know, these are artists who have convey a sense of place. They come from a place at the same time as they invented in their music. So it's both real and imagined. That's what Uncle Tupelo did with Belleville, Illinois. It's an unlikely place. It was a kind of depressed Midwestern town. But they made the texture of that place accessible to people who lived in New York or lived in London or lived in LA and maybe never came within thousands of miles of Illinois. There was a sense that this was a band that was coming out of a particular part of the country, and that lent their music a kind of rooted force that a lot of other music that was being made at that time or since lacked.
Whether you had to be crazy to stay or leave, Belleville obviously fueled the band's imagination, although they were much more Woody Guthrie's Dust Bowl Depression scenes than the bleak visions of their Northwest cousins.
Really, in the late 80s and early 90s, you know, a lot of bands, you know, particularly, I mean, most famously the ones out of Seattle, were, you know, looking at, you know, a kind of very grim view of the world, view of events. What was different about Uncle Tupelo was that even as dark as their vision was, it was rooted in a specific place. It was kind of a portrait of the town of, you know, Belleville, Illinois. There was a sense in which they were both creating that place and rendering it. So the darkness there was a kind of struggle that working class people undergo. So even as they weren't particularly writing protest songs, there was a sense in which their dark vision was not just existential or just philosophical. It was rooted in an actual social reality, which of course implies that that can change, that somehow you can find a way out of that. And that lent their music a force that, at least for me, music by some other bands around that time lacked.
An observant working-class sketchbook filled with everything implied isn't complete without some larger-than-life images. Belleville Stag Brewery was once a major employer. It was an anchor for the town. When it collapsed, it took a lot of the town down with it.
The whistle of the Stag Brewery blew five times during the day, and the last time, that was to tell the children that were at the parks and out different places playing, it was time to come home for dinner.
Hometown, same town blues, same old walls closing in. Well, what a life a mess can be. Well, I'm sitting here thinking of you, won't you give your thoughts to me? Time won't wait, better open the gate. Get out and start, needs to be done. It's winding down, there's much you miss. Working on that graveyard shift. But I'm not saying things won't go wrong. It's day comes along. What I see is true, I can learn. Sunset land of paradise, sunset land of pain. Well, what side are you looking from? Some people have it all, and some want the gain. Well, man, it's hop up your dime for a break, it's $20 bill. There's plenty of reasons in this world, moving along or standing still. But I'm not saying things won't go wrong, instead comes along. What I see is true, I could learn to believe. Can't look away, powers that be. Thank you. time's been looking for a reason. Since the simple ones beat the most truth. Well, what a life a mess can be. Well, I'm sitting here thinking of you, won't you give these thoughts to me? Well, time I'm way better open the gate. Get out, start, needs to be done. It's winding down, there's much you miss. Working on that graveyard shift.
Graveyard Shift from Uncle Tupelo. Mike Heidorn.
I met Jay and Jeff. We all met kind of freshman year in high school at the local high school in Belleville, Illinois, where we were born in the same hospital, and we all lived in the same town. So we went to high school together, and by sophomore year, Jeff and Jay had picked up guitars, and I, for some reason, had bought a three-piece drum set from my mother's garage sale and started playing drums. They heard wind of it. They invited me over, or I just hung out with them to the point where I was playing drums with them.
Jay Farrar.
Before Uncle Tupelo, we started out in a band called The Primitives, which our emphasis in that band was kind of on British invasion, you know, blues, bass, rock, kind of like the Yardbirds and the Rolling Stones and you know, their American counterparts like Chocolate Watch Band, Standells, and stuff like that. So we were kind of in a garage rock, which wasn't popular with everyone else at the time. In the 80s, I think it was kind of the soft metal, big hair. A lot of what we were getting into and listening to was sort of a reaction against all that.
And then there was No Depression.
It was in my parents' record collection, so I started to sort of pilfer through that. My mom had a pretty good folk collection, you know. I was continually looking through that, and that's how I came across the song No Depression. It was on a folk compilation. I think it was the subject matter, really, I thought was kind of striking and cool. I was kind of enraptured by it.
Oh, fear the hearts of men are failing, for these are latter days we know. The Great Depression now is spreading, God's word declared it would be so. I'm going where there's no depression, to a better land that's free from care. I'll leave this world of toil and trouble. My home's in heaven, I'm going there. This dark hour of midnight nearing, and tribulation time will come. Storms will hurl in midnight fear, and sweep lost millions to their doom. I'm going where there's no depression, to a better land that's free from care. I'll leave this world of toil and trouble. My home's in heaven, I'm going there. I'm going where there's no depression. Better land, it's free from care. I'll leave this world, toil and trouble. Home's in heaven, I'm going there. I'm going where there's no depression. To a better land that's free from care. I'll leave this world of toil and trouble. My home's in heaven, I'm going there.
This is The Long Cut, an hour of radio about Uncle Tupelo. I'm Lauren Fry. No Depression the song became No Depression, an early name for what now goes as alt-country. Uncle Tupelo became the boys everyone pointed at when they needed an example. Nobody asked them if they wanted the job, but they got it. Thing was, as much as they loved folk music, they were just as enthused by punk, and they wanted to play it all, sometimes in the same song. As you might guess, they have some ambivalence about being pegged as any one thing. While the punk influences were rising to the surface and started to push out the covers, Johnny Cash and the Bakersfield Country merged with murder ballads and work songs to form the base of the young songwriter's sound. Here's Jay Farrar.
Jeff and I were playing with Mike at that point, and we decided to start writing our own stuff. And, you know, originally it was kind of an amalgam of probably of garage rock and some of the punk rock we had been listening to at the time. And gradually over time, you know, it started to evolve and started to include more of a wide range of influences, you know, from folk to country.
Jay's folks grew up in the Ozark area of southern Missouri, so there was a lot more banjos and acoustics, guitars and mandolins and fiddles in his ears playing on the radio. And the same with Jeff, I presume. I didn't grow up with him before high school, so I hear tell that they had a lot of acoustic guitars at their functions. And accordingly, we would play this music that, at the time, actually, to be honest, I didn't think nothing of it. I knew that Jay was well-read. His mother owned a bookstore. They had probably 10,000 paperback books in there. So he worked there, and he was very well-read, and I'm sure Jeff was too. And it just seemed natural the way they were writing these songs, singing them out. But I really took it for granted, I guess, at the time. Now that I got this anthology in my hands and looking back at it, I didn't really think much of it at the time. But the stuff they were writing about could have been wrote about by somebody in New York City or California or Canada. It didn't necessarily have to be this fictitional Belleville, Illinois, because there was, convenience stores closings and people losing jobs and drunkards, whatever you have, you know, bar life everywhere. So almost unaged. They weren't 19-year-olds singing about whiskey bottles and stuff.
Persuaded, paraded, inebriated, in doubt. Still aware of everything life carries on without. Cause there's one too many faces with dollar sign smiles. I gotta find the shortest path to the bar. Or while a long way from happiness in a 3-hour town. Whiskey bottle. Just for now. Well, there's a trouble around. It's never far away. The same trouble's been around for a life and a day. Well, I can't forget the sound, cause it's here to stay. The sound of people chasing money, money getting away. A long way from happiness. dirt. Disgust there must be. Some air to breathe and something to believe. Well, liquor and guns, the sign says quite plain. Somehow life goes on in a place so insane. Well, I'm away from happy. Just for now.
Whiskey bottle. Here's Jay Farrar.
It wasn't something that, you know, we accepted right away. It was kind of a gradual acceptance, sort of putting the pieces together, you know, knowing that, you know, bands that, even bands like the Beatles, you know, it's sort of done some Carl Perkins and Buck Owens songs, so it just all started to make sense after a while, especially, well, speaking of within the band, you know, because that, you know, folk and country were the types of music that our parents listened to and played, and, you know, it wasn't something that we had an extreme aversion to, but it was something that, you know, that wasn't the primary thing we wanted to do. We wanted to turn up our amps and play loud music.
I Got Drunk, from a loud Uncle Tupelo. Here's Jeff Tweedy.
Punk rock is really just like, you know, the fashion of it and the whole thing about it is it's like a club, and we didn't belong to that club no matter how much we wanted to.
Tripping out of Rico in the rug.
and we would go to see real punk rock bands in St. Louis and see the real club and realize that we were complete geeks, you know, completely off base, you know. We liked the same records and the music and the spirit of it, I think we had right. We just never felt like we fit in that world, and it wasn't something that we bought across the board. I think pretty early on we were starting to listen to folk music and country music and had broadened a little bit to include some of the music that punk was kind of calling us to dismiss. Like Neil Young, it was not a cool thing if you're in a punk rock, if you're punk rocker. Especially the early records, they're sort of weird, like stop start. I listen to them and I can't believe that we managed to memorize those arrangements. You know, for a bunch of kids, they're very bizarrely arranged. And some of that comes from the Minutemen. Some of it is just our peculiar idiosyncrasies, you know, like that we thought that we were trying to do everything at once.
Mike Heidorn.
It just seemed natural for us to play these songs. We had a great appreciation for a Johnny Cash song as we would for a Screaming Black Flag song, too. So I think it was just a matter of being bored with one thing for a very long time. We'll switch it up and change to another style, maybe even the chorus of a song.
Here's Anthony DeCurtis.
There were a lot of reasons why Uncle Tupelo, you know, never became as huge as some other bands did, you know, from the era in which they came up. I think one of them was the kind of individuality of their vision. There was a sense in which, you know, if you wanted to come along on this ride, you were pretty much going to do it on their terms. As friendly as and accessible as they were, particularly, you know, in live performance, you know, they weren't pandering in any way to a larger audience and even to a larger audience's kind of hip assumptions about what a band like Uncle Tupelo should be like. You know, if you were, if you were obsessed with punk, well, they were flashing the Carter Family. If you were a Roots fanatic, well, you know, they were playing in a way that was as torrid and acerbic as any punk band. So in a lot of ways, the things that they were combining, you know, pushed some people away. On the other hand, if all of the cards in their deck, you know, were recognizable to you, you know, their very uniqueness is what, you know, is what made their impact so strong on the people who found their music.
This is The Long Cut, an hour of radio about Uncle Tupelo. I'm Lauren Fry. This is The Long Cut, an hour of radio about Uncle Tupelo. If Uncle Tupelo's willingness to mix up the styles didn't make things complicated enough, it got stranger when the alt-country tag came along. For the band, it was a mixed blessing.
Unfortunately, those terms are...
Jay Farrar.
They're kind of restrictive and reductive for the people creating the music that... Although they're helpful for people who are finding out about the music.
If I listen to any alt country bands today, we have spawned or something like that. None of them really sound like those early couple records that I know of. You know.
Jeff Tweedy.
I don't know what the band's about. I mean, obviously, the world has defined it a little bit. The people that became interested in what we were doing, and especially after the fact, have taken an interest in it. And it's never seemed to me to be quite accurate. And it's really not my place to say. I'm not actively participating in the creation of Uncle Tupelo anymore, you know, and I'm happy that people are listening to it.
Mike Heidorn.
I'm astonished, even with the whole alt-country spearheading that whole tag we have, because it just it's misleading to say the least, because we were just carrying on a fine tradition of other fiddle wielding guitar axe players too.
It's memory of a miner who dragged himself to work, worked himself to death, working for someone else. We follow each other around on shaky ground. His life had become to him worthless in many ways, an expired product off the shelf, working for someone else. We follow each other around on shaky ground.
The stuff, especially from March 16th to the 20th, I feel like that music holds up better than any of it. The early stuff is like, it struck me as just being, wow, we really rehearsed a lot.
Jeff Tweedy.
Well, it was when we've really kind of, I think when we started, we were really, had zero knowledge of what of being in a recording studio is about. So the possibilities were daunting to us. March 16th is the first time we made a record that sounded like us, and it was like very few overdubs. We performed it live, did it very fast, and it was the first time we made the realization that we were better with those limitations. To impose them on ourselves made us better. And also just doing an acoustic folk record at the time, when there wasn't a lot of that around, it felt, I think it was a liberating experience. It felt bold at the time. It felt a very exciting thing to do, to sing these songs that are very, very old next to our own songs, and somehow listen to it and we definitely felt like it made sense, you know.
Here's Jay Farrar.
Yeah, I think it probably is my favorite. I mean, a song like Sandusky, I think, kind of, you know, epitomizes the phase we're into there, where it was just sort of, everything was just kind of done off the cuff. But with the the emphasis was on folk at that point, and we were kind of learning about it, you know, listening to old Library of Congress recordings at the same time we were writing our own songs, and, you know, just kind of came up with a combination of the two.
That is my favorite Uncle Tupelo record, for sure, without a doubt.
Here's Mike Heidorn.
Oddly enough, I had quit the band before that recording. I had told them that I was getting married later on in that year, and was going to be in the family way and whatnot. So I felt like before that album was recorded that I let them know that I wouldn't be able to continue to tour like I was. So they said, "You still want to record this record?" I said, "Sure. For sure I will. If you want to get somebody else, go ahead, but I'll be more than happy to fulfill that." I went down there not having great expectations of what would happen, knowing that we had a short week booked. But I don't know, the combination of the half the album being old covers from the 30s and 40s, and the other half these Jay and Jeff songs that I remember loading out an amp after that session with Jay on the other end of it and saying, ask him a question about a song called Criminals, saying, "Who wrote that song? Is that a 40s song or is that you?" He said, "Oh, it's me." And I was shocked. I had asked, one of the few times I asked, who wrote a song, because usually I knew.
We got two kinds here, those that bleed the blood and those that work to will it. Can't believe the big screen There's no justice in the hall. We're all criminals waiting to be called. We got shackles to keep the laws made by men who bought and sold themselves, with not a prayer to keep the powers at bay. They want us kinder, gentler at their feet. They say don't step off the sidewalk and don't cross over the line. But we'll serve time at night when the lights begin to dim, when the smoke seems to clear. You can't say what you want. We're all criminals here. How many times will the teeth bite their tongue, looking for salvage and the damage that's done? Well, I searched for you every place I thought I knew. Still we're criminals looking for something to do.
The Jay Farrar song, Criminals, from March 16 to 20, 1992. Jeff Tweedy.
I was invigorated by the fact that somebody at a major label was stupid enough to give us a record deal, and that we could potentially be a band that made records that defied the norm, that didn't sound like major label records. We had a lot of reservations about signing with a major label. We'd heard horror stories from lots of different people, and I honestly don't think that those things happen. I thought it was more of a sacrifice than staying on an independent label, to be honest, to be heard. I thought the idea was to be heard, and I still feel that way. Mm-hmm. And that if you're making a decision because the industry is bad and because it's not fair to the artists, you're still, that's just as much of a decision based on money as signing with a major label to get rich. And I don't want to make decisions about music based on money. I want to make decisions based on how efficiently can we get our music out to people who might like it.
The differences in Uncle Tupelo were becoming seams. The stitching that held the band together was fraying, and signing to a major had the effect of soaking a baseball in water. The internal pressure swelled, and Uncle Tupelo started coming apart. Jay Farrar.
I think, speaking for myself, I was, you know, somewhat ambivalent about it. You know, on the one hand, it, you know, seemed like it could be an exciting new phase, but on the other hand, you knew that, you know, things were going to change, and a lot of sort of hard decisions as to how popular or what kind of sacrifices you wanted to make. You know, those kinds of individualistic decisions would have to be made.
Here's Anthony DeCurtis.
I think when Uncle Tupelo started out, there was a sense in which Jay Farrar was absolutely the main guy. You know, he was kind of the custodian of the musical tradition that the band was drawing on, you know, and a forceful songwriter and personality. And in many ways, I think Tweedy idolized him. But as time went on, Jeff Tweedy really began to develop his own voice as a songwriter, and that really shifted the dynamic in Uncle Tupelo. And I think it ultimately bothered Farrar that it was no longer his band. And that tension finally shattered Uncle Tupelo.
Last and I'm dying.
Anodyne was the final Uncle Tupelo album. The band expanded to a quintet and laid down the album in a series of live sessions in Austin. For all the rocking, all the great hooks, and the depth the new players added, Anodyne is still a sad affair. It makes sense. After all, an anodyne is something that has the power to allay pain, something that soothes away the suffering.
By the time of Anodyne, you know, Jay Farrar was uncomfortable with the idea that the band had signed a major label contract. Uncle Tupelo had started out as his band, and I think he just found it unbearable in many ways. And what had been a very deep brotherly friendship really began to disintegrate. I think Tweedy describes himself during that period as being oblivious to it. You know, essentially somebody who, I mean, he once told me that I said, you know, in some ways Anodyne seems like a conversation between the two of you. You know, you're saying, let's take the long cut, you know, we can hold this together. You know, and Jay is saying, you know, this is like Chickamauga to me. I'm in a kind of hell.
Never leave on your own where you're from and where you're going. I know these things like I know you hate me now. Catch yourself midair thinking your dreams can never be bought. I couldn't help you then, and I guess I can't help you now. When jousting is for pleasure, pleasure is way out of hand. The time is right. Chickamauga's where I've been. Solitude is where I'm bound. I don't ever want to taste those tears again. I don't ever want to taste those tears again. Appalachia, so patient. The lesson. Solutions we're after, and avert our chronic impending disaster. Chickamauga's where I've been. Solitude is where I'm bound. I don't ever want to taste those tears
Chickamauga? It's okay, most folks haven't. It's a Native American word and the name of a small river in northern Georgia. The Battle of Chickamauga was fought in September of 1863. It was a desperate, nasty fight, the Confederacy's last shot at winning the war. When the two sides locked, 4,000 men died in 2 days, 35,000 injured. One translation of Chickamauga says it means River of Blood. Anthony de Curtis.
I think in many ways when songwriters of the intensity of J4R and Jeff Tweedy, when they're working together in a band, minor differences become very significant. You know, these are not sensibilities that are worlds apart. But in the hothouse context of a band, very small aesthetic differences can ultimately loom large and ultimately shatter a band. You know, there was always a kind of tension between these two guys, you know. And as in so many cases, out of that tension came a lot of great work. It just became hard to sustain as two guys fronting a band and being out on the road and, you know, all of the work and pressure that all brings.
Here's Jeff Tweedy.
I loved being in Uncle Tupelo. I don't think if Jay hadn't left, it probably would have taken me a long time to really feel like I needed to get out on my own because I had something special I had to say or anything like that. Nothing like that was driving me. I was really comfortable having to come up with 6 songs a year that were really great. Having a team, it was an ideal way to work. And having said that, I'm also really happy that I was forced and to come to terms with being a songwriter and being a singer forced me to move on and figure out what it is that I did want to play and sound like and say.
Jay Farrar.
Yeah, well, it was a lot of different factors. I think, you know, the major one being that Mike had left the band after the March record, and, you know, that sort of changed the chemistry. It wasn't three guys from Belleville against the world anymore. It was kind of Jeff and I, and we were trying to create a new identity, you know, and it just didn't really seem to be an easy thing to do. So, you know, at that time I felt it was time for a change, and I thought that it was necessary for both he and I to, you know, mature as songwriters and as people.
You know, there's a mythology that's arisen around this band. You know, any band that has never achieved its potential commercially becomes alluring. Uncle Tupelo is a kind of signifier for a concern for authenticity, for a kind of a desire to make music that's not determined by the mainstream. You know, they have all of that kind of symbolic resonance for, you know, new listeners, and they're endlessly going to be rediscovered. In many ways, through no fault of their own, Uncle Tupelo launched a movement, which now we know as alternative country. But the things that they were combining, when they were combining them, you know, just seemed weird to many people. But now it's a matter of course. You know, there's been more than a decade, almost now 15 years of bands that have taken inspiration from what Uncle Tupelo did. And that's why they're significant. Another thing that really lends Uncle Tupelo a kind of mythic status in a lot of ways, or allows people to enter it even now, you know, years after the band broke up, is the fact that they seemed just about on the point of reaching a larger audience. You know, they'd signed a major label deal. They, you know, made a really good record in Anodyne. And there was a sense that the stage was set. And, of course, right at that moment, things fell apart. It's almost as if when Uncle Tupelo was deteriorating towards the very end, it's as if you were in a relationship that was essentially over, except the sex was really good. You know, when they got on stage, that was like the sex. You know, it had that kind of intensity and force and power. You know, everything, all of the problems, all of the good things came to bear on that night in that club, and they just tore it up.
Sound like the sun on the horizon. Now I think we've been had. turntable, there's no call waiting in my headphones. And every star that shines in the back of my mind is just waiting for its cover to be. There's a new drum bleeding, yes, in my head. How could I still be so in love when I know we've been had? Republicans, Democrats, can't give you the facts. Your parents won't tell you until you're grown. And every star that shines in the back of your mind is just waiting for its cover to be blown. Just like the law of averages, nobody likes them where they're from. And every star that hides on the back of the bus is just waiting for its cover to be.
Live Uncle Tupelo from their farewell tour, We've Been Had. Really? Not hardly, although that does just about bring us to the end of the long cut, an hour of radio about Uncle Tupelo. It's kind of a sad ending, but things aren't too bad. All of Uncle Tupelo's records, which for the most part have been out of print and pretty hard to find, are going to be coming out soon. They'll have extra songs and a freshened up sound. Talk to your favorite local music proprietor for the whole story. Thanks Adam Block, Tom Corden, John Jackson, Jeff Jones, John Vernile, Tracy Tenenbaum, David Dye, and the World Cafe. The show was put together by Paul Chufo and Michael L. Sesser at Joyride Media. I'm Lauren Fry. Bye now.